guest today is Mike Campbell. He is the author of Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. His website is EarhartTruth.com. And you say there are 1,500 books at Amazon just about Amelia Earhart.
Right. And of those 1,500 books, 99.9% of those books are biographies, for the most part, novels, children's books make up a great deal of those, fantasies, and all manner of nonsense make up 99.9% of those books. Out of all 1,500 plus books on Amazon about Earhart, there's only 10 books that present any aspects of the truth about what actually happened to her. This in itself would give the listener or the layperson that doesn't know anything about the story an idea. This should raise a red flag and ring a bell. Why is he saying this? Why is he saying only 10 books present the truth about Earhart? What is so special about this truth about Earhart? Well, we're going to get to that. But it's a fact that nobody except Fred Gerner, no known journalist in the history of the United States except Fred Gerner in 1960, ever took this story on, ever investigated this story, because it's been so hated. And when the story probably killed him, it probably shortened his life, and it made him a very unhappy man. Even though he thought he was going to be famous and he thought he was going to be rich, it's my opinion that it made him a very unhappy man, and that it sent him to an early grave because of the way that the establishment treated him and treated, as has always treated, the truth in this, as if it's something that we just don't discuss. We don't discuss this in polite society. This is why it's fallen to someone like me, a completely unknown Navy journalist, to actually do the book, the representative, the definitive book to this date on the Earhart thing. And there's no doubt about that. My book has been number one since July of all Earhart books, not just disappearance books, but it's
wonderful.
Been number one. That's because people find it themselves, though. It's not because anyone in the media directs them there. Not at all. People that want to – this is – the truth about the Earhart situation is a secret lying in plain sight. All you have to do is look for it, and you'll find it. But the media will never, ever direct anyone, with rare exceptions, you being one, and one very special one, Deanna. Yeah, and so back to 19.
I like the truth. I appreciate the truth. And when I first heard about you and looked at your work, it just struck home.
And absolutely. And it's not. This is something that is just so hated. I mean, it's just so hated. Anyway, let's get back to the facts. Daughter of the Sky, 1960. Paul Briant. This book is what began the modern search for Amelia Earhart. In the last chapter of Briant's book, now Briant was a captain at the Air Force Academy. He was an Air Force captain. He was in the military. He was an English professor at the Air Force Academy, of all places. Okay, and at the end of this book, Briant had come into some privileged information recently while he was working on his book by a Navy dentist, okay, by the name of Casimir Schecht, S-H-E-F-T. This Casimir Schecht was a Navy dentist on Saipan during the late 40s. And during his time on Saipan, Schecht had a dental assistant, hygienist-type person there that worked with him. Her name was Josephine Blanco. Josephine Blanco told Casimir Schecht about something that she saw at Tanapag Harbor on Saipan in 1937. She told him she saw a silver twin-engine plane, belly land in the harbor at Tanapag, and two white flyers emerge. This information that Schaft got, I mean, of course, was stunning to him once he understood what it was. This found its way to Paul Briand. Paul Briand published this information at the end of his book in the last chapter. Now, Paul Briand did not directly interview Josephine. He took what Casimir Schaft told him and included it in the close of his book. So I'm going to read basically how Briand started this, and this is very notable stuff. 1960, okay, at the end of the book, I'm quoting now from Briand. In the summer of 1937, Josephine was riding her bicycle toward Tanapag Harbor. She was taking her Japanese brother-in-law, J.Y. Matsumoto, as lunch and was hurrying along because it was nearly 12 o'clock. Josephine had special plans, a special pass to the Japanese military area near the harbor. Not even Japanese civilians were admitted to the area unless they carried the proper credentials. The young girl rode up to the gate, stopped her bicycle, and presented her pass. The guard allowed her into the restricted area. On the way to meet her brother-in-law, Josephine heard an airplane flying overhead. She looked up and saw it, a silver two-engine plane. The plane seemed to be in trouble, for it came down low, headed out in the harbor, and belly landed on the water. It was not until she met her brother-in-law that Josephine discovered whom it was that had crash-landed in the harbor. The American woman, everyone was saying, greatly excited, come and see the American woman. Josephine and her brother-in-law joined a knot of people who got gathered to watch. She saw the American woman standing next to a tall man wearing a short-sleeved sports shirt and was surprised because the woman was not dressed as a woman usually dressed. Instead of a dress, the American woman wore a man's shirt and trousers, and instead of long hair, she wore her hair cut short like a man. The faces of the man and woman were white and drawn as if they were sick. Briand added that Josephine had identified a photo of Earhart and Noonan as absolutely being that of the same man and woman she saw on Saipan in 1937. Okay, so this,
wow,
this is the key passage. This is what really set off the modern day search for Amelia Earhart. Nothing else, nothing that you hear from, you know, the phony media. This is what started it. And so what happened was, this soon became, after the book was published, it soon became known, and a local writer in San Mateo, California, named Linwood Day, who wrote for the San Mateo Times, just outside of San Francisco, Linwood Day saw this from Briand. He became very interested, and as a matter of fact, Josephine lived in San Mateo. They had moved from Saipan, she had gotten married, and she was now Josephine Blanco Akiyama. And he went and interviewed her in 1960. He began to do a series of stories about Josephine and what she saw on Saipan. And the first story appeared in the San Mateo Times, May 27, 1960. I'm quoting now. A San Mateo woman who may have been one of the last to see Amelia Earhart alive says that the famed aviatrix was executed by a Japanese firing squad even while the U.S. Navy was spending $4 million on a futile search for the missing flyer and her navigator, Frederick Noonan. Okay, now that is the lead from Linwood Day on May 27, 1960. He was new to this story, and this is all he knew, and this is all he was able to glean at that time from Josephine. However, there's much more to the story. Josephine did not know exactly what happened to them. She was speculating herself. They were not executed right away by any firing squad. Now, what happened was Fred Gerner saw the stories that were being published in the San Mateo Times. A guy named Fred Gerner was a radio personality in San Francisco. And Gerner, who is still known as the most famous researcher in Earhart history, Gerner went and he interviewed Josephine. He interviewed her husband. And he was quite taken with this story. He believed it, and he got permission from CBS Radio to go to Saipan in June of 1960, mid-June. for the first of his four trips to Saipan to investigate the story. Now, in June of 1960, Gerner had CBS money and CBS backing to do this. He went there, and the first thing he did when he got to Saipan was he enlisted the aid of the three Catholic priests on Saipan, the missionary priests on Saipan. Now, the people on Saipan were not English-speaking. They're called Chamorros. The native Saipanese are called Chamorros, and they spoke Spanish. So Gerner needed translators, so he got these priests to serve as his translators, and because he knew that the Chamorros there on Saipan were near almost practically 100% Catholic. They were afraid of those priests, and they would not lie in their presence, besides the fact that they would serve as translators. This is one of the big lies that's told just even recently, not that long ago, in the New York Times. One of the big water carriers for the lies said that the witnesses on Saipan were happy to be in the spotlight, and they told Gerner what he wanted to hear. Nothing could be further from the truth. These people on Saipan were very shy, retiring types. They had never even been around cameras before. They didn't even know what they were. They partly knew what radio was on Saipan in 1937. They probably didn't. So when Gerner shows up in 1960, he got the truth from the people that he talked to. He talked to about 200 native witnesses originally. Now, most of the people that he talked to on Saipan were not eyewitnesses to the arrival of Earhart and Noonan in 1936 because the Tanapag Harbor area was off limits. Most people were not there. Most people were not hanging around the off limits area to see them being brought in by a Navy launch. There were a few, however, that saw that. There were many others that saw them later on the island in different capacities. And so what Gerner was able to put together was what he called his his original 13 witnesses, and that they formed the basis of the huge story that broke in the San Mateo Times on July 1st, 1960. Okay, now this is what the San Mateo Times the headline looked like in 1960. The headline was 100-point headlines: Amelia Earhart mystery is solved. 100 points. And then underneath it says, the mystery of the fate of Amelia Earhart was solved today, 23 years to the day that she vanished with her navigator over the lonely Pacific. Brilliant on-the-scene reporting on the island of Saipan and an unparalleled newspaper radio cooperative venture ripped the veil from the baffling puzzle of the disappearance of the First Lady of the Air on July 2nd, 1937. Radio newsman Fred Gerner and Massimo Akiyama unlocked the door to the mystery in a vividly dramatic 11,000-mile journey to Saipan, sponsored jointly by the Times and radio station KCBS of San Francisco. Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan crash landed in the Garapan Harbor near the Tanapag Naval Base on Saipan in 1937. A Japanese naval launch picked up the two flyers and brought them to shore. They were taken to the military headquarters, questioned, and separated. Noonan was forced into an automobile by his captors and was never seen again. Well, never seen again by some. Amelia was moved to a small building at the military barracks compound. This is the July 1st, 1960 story. Very little of that is inaccurate, even to this day. You know, for all intents and purposes, that story is as true today as it was in 1960.
Right.
Okay. So,
the history behind Saipan is very interesting. And that they were Catholic and they spoke Spanish, and this is very interesting. And you're right; they were not motivated by their ego. They were just telling the truth.
Absolutely, you know. And so, Gerner was really that was the moment in 1960 when Gerner, when that became his life's mission from then on in. He died in 1994 at the age of 69 from cancer. From 1960 until 1966, and he went there, he went back to Saipan four times. He found lots of new witnesses besides the original 13 that he saw. One of the original 13 was, we just don't have time to go through everything. There's just no way. But, we'll talk about some of the more notable people. One of them who really has always been one of my favorites is a man named Dr. Manuel Aldon. Dr. Aldon was a dentist on Saipan. He was an educated man, by no means unsophisticated, bilingual, of course. And in 1937, Dr. Aldon was taking care of Japanese officers on Saipan because the Japanese ruled Saipan. They tyrannized the island. The people were little more than slaves to them. They were building up. They were beginning the buildup. They had began as Lido Field, which was the airfield there. They had built a seaplane base, had already been finished at Tanapag Harbor in Saipan. So there wasn't much room for Dr. Aldon to take care of normal people. The Japanese just commandeered his practice, and they used him for their own purposes. And the officers told Aldon about the white woman and the white man, the flyers that they had in captivity in 1937. And Aldon, in 1960, told Fred Gerner what they told him. And Aldon said, "Japanese officers tell me the name of the flyer, of the lady flyer. Her name, Erharto." You know, that's the way he described it, Erharto, with an exclamation point. Okay? You know, as far as I'm concerned, case closed right there. Who else could it have possibly been?
Right.
Okay? I mean, there's no doubt at all. There's just no question at all. But the evidence is mountainous. Absolutely mountainous that reflects the truth of her presence and death on Saipan. Aldon is just one of many. Based on what Gerner saw, and what he learned from his witnesses, Gerner. Let me see here. What are we going to say? We said that they were taken to the military headquarters. And yeah, so none of the witnesses actually knew exactly what happened to them. We still don't have a convincing eyewitness to the death of Amelia Earhart. We have one witness who claimed to see a white woman executed in 1944, shortly before the American invasion of Saipan. That's the only one that claims to have been an eyewitness. She was interviewed by Buddy Brennan in his book, Witness to the Execution, which came out a year after Devine's book. But this woman, Mrs. Navius Cabrera, her account, although it's fascinating, it's not convincing to me. Based on all the other evidence that we have about Earhart and about her death. First of all, if she was seen in 1944 executed, that means she lived on Saipan for 7 years before she was killed. Right. Everything that everybody else tells us, it says that didn't happen, that it couldn't have happened. For example, we have Joaquina Cabrera, who is another one of my favorite witnesses. In 1962, she was interviewed by Gerner. That was his third trip. Let me think. Yes, I think that was his third trip to Saipan. I'm reading now what Gerner wrote. Mrs. Joaquina Cabrera brought us closer to the woman held at the Kobayashi Royal Can Hotel than any other witness.
All righty, we're at a break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing, knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds, up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it. At AROutfitting.com.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Mike Campbell. He is the author of Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. His website is EarhartTruth.com. All righty.
All righty. All right, we were with Joaquina Cabrera, who was one of Fred Gerner's original witnesses on Saipan. Actually, not one of the original 13. He interviewed Joaquina in 1962 on his third trip there. And we were saying that Joaquina Cabrera brought us closer. I'm reading Gerner now. Brought us closer to the woman held at the Kobayashi Ryokan Hotel. That was the two-story hotel on Saipan where the Japanese kept their political prisoners there. Gerner wrote, at the Cabrera home in Chalon, Kanoa, Gerner and several others, including Fathers Arnold Bendowski and Sylvan Conover, and Ross Game, who was editor of the Napa, California Register, and he was a longtime Gerner confidant. They all crowded into the front room and listened to her halting recital. Cabrera said nothing about delivering daily lists of people staying at the hotel, describing her job as that of a laundress for the Japanese guests and prisoners held there. They had guests and prisoners at this hotel. Now, Joaquina said to Gerner, I'm quoting now, one day when I came to work, they were there, a white lady and man. The police never left them. The lady wore man's clothes when she first came. I was given her clothes to clean. I remember pants and a jacket. It was leather or heavy cloth, so I did not wash it. I rubbed it clean. The man I saw only once. I did not wash his clothes. His head was hurt and covered with a bandage, and he sometimes needed help to move. The police took him to another place, and he did not come back. The lady was thin and very tired. Every day, more Japanese came to talk with her. She never smiled to them, but did to me. She did not speak our language, but I know she thanked me. She was a sweet, gentle lady. I think the police sometimes heard her. She had bruises, and one time her arm was hurt. Then one day, police said she was dead of disease, dysentery, or Joaquina called it amoeba, which is their word for dysentery. Joaquina said the woman was kept at the hotel for many months, perhaps a year. She heard the man had also died, though she didn't know the cause of his demise, and she thought the woman was buried in the cemetery near Garapan, long since reclaimed by the jungle. That's wow. Yeah, that's Joaquina Cabrera to basically to Fred Gerner. She was also interviewed by Joe Gervais and Robert Dinger in 1960 on Saipan. They were allowed to go and follow Gerner. They weren't allowed on Saipan right away. They were Air Force officers. They did a lot of important work in as far as interviewing some eyewitnesses, Gervais and Dinger did. Most of the witnesses that they found actually were on Guam who had lived on Saipan. The ones that they actually put in the book, Amelia Earhart Lives, which was published in 1970. Amelia Earhart Lives starts out great with great work from Gervais and Dinger on Guam and Saipan with witnesses, adding to what we know, you know, adding to the witness count very impressively. However, Gervais, Joe Gervais, who has among Earhart researchers, is a very polarizing figure. People either love him or they don't love him. I'm not one of his great admirers. He caused a lot of trouble, a lot of dissension, and he put out a lot of disinformation that did a lot of damage. Okay, to the Earhart cause, to the cause of research, of Earhart research, and we didn't need it, because we have enough problems as it is with the establishment trying to squelch the truth and trying to dismiss and debunk the truth and trying to smear it at every opportunity. Now, Gervais, at the end of the book, Amelia Earhart Lives, which written by his friend Joe Kloss, who was also an Air Force officer at that time. Kloss was a public affairs officer and a good writer, and he wrote this book called Amelia Earhart Lives. As I said, it started out good, but it gets into all kind of nonsense soon after the witness interviews. He gets into these made-up codes, and then at the end of the book, Irene Bolam is introduced. The Irene Bolam lie is introduced, and it really did a lot of damage.
I wonder if that was deliberate. All right, we'll be back in 3 minutes.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Did you know that neither the American Medical Association nor the American Bar Association were established to benefit the American people? Have you recognized that in our country, health care has little to do with health, and that our court system has nothing to do with justice? The priests of both medicine and law have been incentivized to implement a dark agenda on behalf of the Bilderbergers and their ilk. To protect ourselves and our progeny, we need to take a much closer look at how these two giant industries really work. Join me, Al Whitney, on In Defense of Humanity, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Central, as we expose the matrix and learn how not to consent to our own destruction.
Extendivite, a seven-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Mike Campbell. He is the author of Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. His website is earharttruth.com, and I question whether that deception was deliberate to just misguide people. And what do you think?
That's a good question, Deanna. It really is. I can't answer it. Because there was so many other things that, that Gervais was wrong about. So many other things that he introduced that he was wrong about. But he was accepted by the Amelia Earhart Society and by Bill Primack, one of the most credible of all the researchers in the last 30 years, accepted as being someone who stood for the truth, who stood for the Earhart of Amelia's present and death on Saipan, and so. But then when you look at what he did and the Irene Bolam falsehood, which so mixed up things and so badly confused things for a while, it's a fair question to ask. Did he do this on purpose? Was he some sort of an agent of disinformation that was inserted into the Earhart community? I think it's very, very possible. It's very possible. We certainly don't know. I don't have any paperwork on that. You know, I don't have that anything that could prove it. But his contributions or lack of same compared to the credit that he got for things are completely out of whack, because that book so discredited Earhart Research. His claim that this New Jersey housewife named Irene Bolam was actually Amelia Earhart returned from Japan.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. That's part of it, too, that she actually went from Saipan to Japan. And then she was eventually repatriated from Waishan, an internment camp, a Japanese internment camp in 1945, and returned as Irene Bolam. It's just an incredible fantasy. And Irene Bolam was so outraged by this claim in the book that she she had a press conference in New York in 1970, right after the book came out, and she threatened a lawsuit, a defamation lawsuit, against McGraw-Hill. And McGraw-Hill pulled the book, Amelia Earhart Lives, from the shelves after 7 weeks, and the book stayed out of circulation for 25 years, until eventually Joe Kloss got the book back, got rights to the book back. And the book is available right now to people that want to buy it. I wouldn't recommend it. But the book did an incredible amount of damage. Joe Kloss claims that he's passed away recently. Not recently. A couple years ago, 2014, I believe, Joe Kloss. Joe Gervais died in 2005. But Kloss said that he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize until the book was pulled from the shelves. Kloss was a very good writer, though. He wrote some very good, very interesting stuff. He was also Kloss was a German prisoner of war during World War II. He was a pilot, and he wrote a book called Maybe I'm Dead, a very well known novel about his captivity as a POW by the Nazis in Europe. So, you know, Kloss didn't have to do this to himself. You know, he already had a good reputation as a writer, and as far as I'm concerned, he really tainted it by getting involved with Gervais and getting involved with this Bolam thing. And it just went on and on in Earhart circles, people actually believing this ridiculous story, and to the point where in 2003 another book was written that tried to resurrect all this stuff, called Amelia Earhart Survives by Roland Reinick, who was a well-known Earhart researcher who wrote, was on Saipan in 1944, and flew B-29s off of Tinian and Saipan to bomb the Japanese mainland. Okay, that's how far he went back, Reinick. And so he was a credible guy, too, in many ways. And he fell off the deep end over this Bolam thing. Okay, I mean, by the time it got to Reinick, the damage was already done. I mean, it was only just the fights were internecine, however you say that word, between Earhart Research people, and the AES. And actually, that book became the death of the Amelia Earhart Society. After that book and the flap that it caused in internal circles, the death of Reinick, and then later deaths of other people involved, and now there's nothing left. There's really no Amelia Earhart Society anymore at all to speak of. So, yeah. So that's a quickie on that. I think it's about time, though. We're over halfway through. To your good listeners that are listening and that have been hanging in, they probably want to know, before we get into more specifics about witnesses or other things, what really happened, big picture wise, what happened, what we know happened, what we have all the witnesses and the evidence to prove happened. Okay, so we're just going to give a minute or two, big picture wise, and then we'll get back to specifics. Big picture wise, what happened? The Electra landed at Milia Atoll. And Amelia Tall is 830 miles northwest of Howland Island. And it would have been about, if it was a direct flight, if they flew directly from Ley to Millie, it would have been a shorter flight than it would have been to Howland Island. It would have been about 1,900 miles, I believe, if they flew directly to Millie. I'm not saying that they did that. They did land there, however. We have witnesses that saw them land there. Two fishermen saw them land there, and a woman named Mrs. Clements, who was interviewed by Vincent V. Loomis, saw them land, saw the plane land. So we know that they landed at Millie. We're going to get into more of that, of those details in a minute. But we know the plane landed at Millie up near Barry Island. Now, an atoll, a Pacific atoll, is like basically circular or a quadrangular type of arrangements of islands in the central Pacific and in a lagoon in the middle. And we believe, Primack believed, that she landed in the lagoon side of Millie Atoll, up near Bar Island, which would have been the northwest quadrant of the island, near three islands called the Endrickens, E-N-D-R-I-K-E-N-S, Endrickens. They're little islands. That means tiny in Marshallese, I believe. So we know that she landed there, crash landed there, okay? We don't know why. That's one of the true mysteries. Why did she land there?
Why?
We don't know why. We don't know why she landed there. We don't know if it was a plan, if she was planning to do that. We don't know if that's where she ran out of gas. We don't know. Likely she did run out of gas there, but what was she doing running out of gas near Millie Atoll? Okay. Had she overflown truck? Possibly. That's one of the most popular theories, that she overflew truck, took some snapshots at the request of FDR. She told two witnesses that she was asked by FDR to do that, to go on a mission, and she told two witnesses, one of which is reliability is questionable, the other one more credible. Her mother also told the Los Angeles Times that she was on some sort of a mission, not to overfly truck, though. And neither did she tell the other witnesses that specifically that she was supposed to overfly truck. But the truck would have been the most logical thing for her to do. It was about, 700 to 900 miles north, slightly northeast of Ley, New Guinea. And they would have reached there about 7 o'clock that night in July. There would have been plenty of light. She could have taken snapshots then and shown FDR what the Japanese were doing with their naval base on truck, because it was 1937. They were building up their Gibraltar of the Pacific, is what truck was eventually called. And so it's possible that's what she was doing. And then once they got finished with truck, that then she headed down toward Millie from truck. That would have made the flight, instead of 56 miles, it would have made the flight about 3,500 miles altogether, okay? Which would have really taxed their 4,000-mile limit, because the 4,000-mile limit was basically their ideal, in ideal conditions. So any kind of a headwind would cut back on their capability mileage-wise, okay? This is what Gurner believed, and this is what was published in True Magazine, 1966, before the book was published. Now, in his book in 1966, he did not really show the same map, and he was a little bit more guarded in what he theorized. Okay, in True Magazine, he theorized, they showed a map that. That showed the Electra going from Ley up to truck and then down toward Howland. Now, before it got to Howland, it turned back toward Millie, ostensibly because Jalowit was there with a 50,000-watt radio station to home in on, because she was running out of gas, and they were not sure if they could make it to Howland at that time. This is the conjecture, all speculation. And so as she is on her way to Jalowit, she didn't make it to Jalowit. She would have landed at Millie. That would make sense. Okay, this is very possible. However, it's by no means proven. And it's just a very strong theory. There's other reasons why she could have landed at Millie. She could have tried to reach Howland as she was as the plan was, and they might have gotten lost somehow. That something might have gone wrong, and they might have been north of their target, started to run out of gas, and then turned toward Millie. However, I mean, that's more of a stretch because Noonan was a great navigator. They had plenty of gas to get there in a straight line. The messages appeared to be kosher. They were becoming stronger and stronger as they approached Howland. So if the messages were becoming stronger as they approached Howland, how could they have been way up near Truk at that time or on their way down to Howland from Millie or from Truk about halfway at that same time? So there's been ideas. Paul Raffert, very well-known researcher who wrote a book called Amelia Earhart's Radio, he theorized that they were pre-recorded messages in submarines, that actually pre-recorded messages to Howland that would make it appear as if Amelia was trying to get to Howland, but she really wasn't. Uh-huh. One of the crewmen on Howland was a guy named William Galton, and he told Raffert that Amelia never intended to land there. He was absolutely convinced that she never intended to land there. One of the major reasons, I believe, is because she was never on the air for more than 10 seconds. If she wanted them to find her, to get a fix on her and to help her find the island, why was she never on the air for more
exactly.
than 10 seconds? That's a real key tell to me. So
yes.
So, you know, we just don't know for sure. We just don't know for sure. Now, big picture, she landed at Millie. She was at Millie for a certain amount of time before a Japanese fishing boat picked her up. We don't know the exact date that she was picked up. We do know that it's most likely that she was picked up by a Japanese fishing boat before she was transferred to the Japanese survey ship Koshu, K-O-S-H-U. I have a headline right now that ran in the United States in a small paper in Pennsylvania called, and the headline says, Tokyo hears Jap fishing boat picked up Amelia. That we also have secondhand information that the Japanese advertiser in Tokyo actually ran a similar headline, that it was known in Tokyo that she had been picked up. Once the political ramifications, however, were explained to the editors and the publishers of that newspaper, it was swiftly taken off the press, and it was swiftly gobbled up as much as they could and hidden. So she was with a Japanese fishing boat, and she was picked up at some point by the Koshu and taken to Jalawit, where they were next seen by a witness. Jalawit is another atoll right next to Millie. It was right around July. It was between July 13th and July 19th that they arrived at Jalawit. They left Jalawit July 19th. We're not exactly – they were sent from Jalawit to go pick the flyers up on July 13th. Okay? So she arrived back there between those dates. And this guy, Japanese-born or possibly, yeah, Japanese or Marshallese-born. There's an argument going on about that, too. His name was Bilemon Amaron. He was 16 years old. He was a Japanese hospital corpsman. And he took care of the flyers on board the Koshu. He saw the white woman on the deck there. She was not seriously injured at all. The white man had a knee injury. He had a white bandage on his head. Throughout their journey from there to Saipan, witnesses saw the white man. Different witnesses in different locations all described the white man as having a white bandage on his head. And Jalawit, Bilemon, 16 years old, working for the Japanese, heard the crewmen call her Melia. M-E-E-L-Y-A. That's what he was quoted as saying to Bill Primack. Melia, Melia. Okay? Now, that's a money quote if I ever heard one right there. Okay, and he also took care of Noonan, bandaged his knee. Bilemon Amaron told this story to many researchers through the years, Bill Primack being one in 1989. Prior to that, Bilemon Amaron taking care of them at Jalo Wood, we have the natives' description of them at Jalo, at Millie, getting into a rowboat or into a life raft, and they said that it was a yellow boat which grew. It was described by these unsophisticated Marshallese natives as a yellow boat which grew, which could have been nothing more else except an inflatable life raft, a yellow boat which grew. Okay, so that's very realistic in the way it would have been described. Sure. Okay, so then from Jalowit, the Flyers.
Oh, my goodness. All righty, we're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
Did you know that neither the American Medical Association nor the American Bar Association were established to benefit the American people? Have you recognized that in our country, health care has little to do with health and that our court system has nothing to do with justice? The priests of both medicine and law have been incentivized to implement a dark agenda on behalf of the Bilderbergers and their ilk. To protect ourselves and our progeny, we need to take a much closer look at how these two giant industries really work. Join me, Al Whitney, on In Defense of Humanity, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Central, as we expose the matrix and learn how not to consent to our own destruction.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Do you or a loved one suffer migraine headaches? Listen to what scientist Kurt Hendricks has to say.
35 million people in the United States suffer with debilitating migraines. If you or a loved one are one of them, you need to know about MigraLeaf. Hi, I'm Kurt Hendricks, the scientist that formulated and patented the MigraLeaf migraine formula. MigraLeaf is a non-prescription dietary supplement recommended by neurologists, pharmacists, and pediatricians to address nutritional deficiencies in both adults and children over 2 with migraines. Try MigraLeaf for 3 months and see the powerful difference it can make in your life or get your money back, no questions asked. Go to MIG911.com or call 800-MIG-7354. You can change your life today.
So if you suffer from migraines, don't wait. Call 800-MIG-7354. That's 800-MIG-7354 or visit MIG911.com.
Our guest today is Mike Campbell, the author of Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. And you're talking about this lifeboat, this yellow boat that grew. There was also talk about them burying a silver container.
Right. Well, okay, that's one of the most fascinating aspects. People say there's no hard evidence at all of any of these claims. Now, Oliver Knaggs returned to Millie in 1982 after he had gone there once with Vincent V. Loomis, who wrote a very important book called Amelia Earhart, The Final Story. Knaggs later wrote a book called Amelia Earhart, Her Final Flight. Some natives claimed they saw a white man bury something that appeared to be a tin case or something like this. Mm. Eventually, Knaggs located what might have been the tin case, but by the time he got there in 1982, it was almost completely disintegrated. It was hardly recognizable as a tin case. But he did take all this because of the sand, I suppose. It was very acidic or whatever. The composition of the sand, it really did a number on this. But it was taken back to South Africa, and it was analyzed by scientific metallurgy, and it was identified as being man-made of a very fine metal, or whatever, however they described it, and it could have possibly been the tin case that was seen. And then if you go back to some of the literature, Fred Noonan did own such a tin case, and Amelia wrote about it in Last Flight, her last book. Her and Amelia and Putnam combined on the last book, that she wrote, and he wrote together because she disappeared, of course, Last Flight. And during that flight, she did talk about Fred Noonan getting this tin case. So that's another piece. I wrote a long blog, a big blog about that. I said, hard evidence. There's hard evidence right there, as far as I'm concerned. Hard evidence of their presence at Millie.
Sure.
So now we're on Jalawit with Bilimon Amaron, who had taken care of the flyers. Now from Jalawit, we know that the Electra was on the back of the Koshu, and the Electra was taken from Jalawit to Saipan. The flyers, however, were taken to Kwajalein from Jalawit, because we have a lot of evidence of that. We also have a native witness who told Paul Raffert that he saw the flyers get on a land-based plane at Kwajalein. Now, if they've got on a land-based plane at Kwajalein, that means that they flew from Kwajalein to Saipan, which is 1,500 miles, no problem. And same thing with a seaplane, however. So Kwajalein had seaplane base, and they could have flown in a seaplane and landed at Tanapag Harbor in 1937, and it's been seen by Josephine. We don't know if it was a land-based plane or a seaplane that an 11-year-old girl thought was belly landing in the harbor. There's just no way to tell for sure, okay? So, and it's not really important, not with everything else that we have.
All righty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back in 3 minutes.
This is too good to be true, except this time it is real. 100%. No joke. How about a $25,000 membership to Front Sight Firearms Training Facility as a thank you bonus for a one-time donation to RBN of only $500? It is a Commander Lifetime membership with no yearly fees or dues. The training is free for the rest of your life with over 50 different classes. Then leave it to your designated beneficiary. You provide the approved firearm, holster, ammo, eye, and ear protection. Many features and bonuses are included, more than you would ever expect or believe. This is the ultimate graduation present, wedding gift, etc., etc. See the details. Go to RBN's webpage and frontsite.com to make it happen. May 5th is the last day you will hear this offer on this radio network. Help keep RBN alive. Tell 5.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.